August. Durleth. August. So, hey, here we are at the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, etc. of August. The second half of August. Here we are. We've got some Donald Wandry. We've got some August Durleth. And do you know something that August Durleth published for Arkham House back in the day? Camilla. Andrew Grace and some other folks talking about Camilla in the future, coming up on the show, and also going to be doing another one of our writer talks where we talk to writer Zach Ferguson again. You might remember him from an episode of People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos where he talks about Fritz Lang, and another one he talked about Ramsey Campbell way back when, and we've had him on here and there. And anyway, Zach will be joining us later this month, and thank you again for listening to Black Clock Audio Tales. I'm your host, DB Spitzer. This is a daily podcast where you get to listen to a chapter of a short story or a chapter of a horror story or gothic story or anything like that. Folklore, one day at a time, hear a couple of stories, 20 minutes at least, you know, something to keep you going on your commute, your flight, your travels, your daily bits and whatnot that you do to keep sane and, well, I don't know, doing dishes or, I don't know, maybe it's something you like to do when you're barbecuing like me. I like to listen to various podcasts like Ken and Robin talk about stuff in Harmontown when I'm barbecuing out in the backyard. Fun stuff. Anyway, so if you want to keep this podcast going and People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos and us exploring weird fiction and all that kind of fun stuff, be sure to check out pgttcm.podbean.com and become a patron. Not Patreon. We don't go with Patreon. Or you can go to paypal.me/pgttcm and donate whatever you think is going to help us keep going. If you want to do it on a regular basis, that's great. If you want to just do a one-time thing, that's cool too. And if you don't want to send us money, you just want something cool in return, go to threadless.com, look for pgttcm/. I don't know which one it is, but just look for pgttcm on threadless.com and get a shirt, get a tote bag, whatever. It helps support the show and keeps us going. We've got some cool designs up right now for logos for the show. We've got Cthulhu designs. We've got various weird fiction authors and horror authors t-shirt designs, and got a new Ratfink-inspired Sathagwa t-shirt up there right now. And all right, thank you so much. And remember to rate, review, subscribe wherever you rate, review, and subscribe.
Carmilla by J. Sheridan LeFanu. Read by Elizabeth Klett. Chapter 13. The Woodman. There soon, however, appeared some drawbacks. In the first place, Millarca complained of extreme languor, the weakness that remained after her late illness, and she never emerged from her room till the afternoon was pretty far advanced. In the next place, it was accidentally discovered, although she always locked her door on the inside, and never disturbed the key from its place till she admitted the maid to assist at her toilet, that she was undoubtedly sometimes absent from her room in the very early morning, and at various times later in the day, before she wished it to be understood that she was stirring. She was repeatedly seen from the windows of the Schloss, in the first faint grey of the morning, walking through the trees, in an easterly direction, and looking like a person in a trance. This convinced me that she walked in her sleep. But this hypothesis did not solve the puzzle. How did she pass out from her room, leaving the door locked on the inside? How did she escape from the house without unbarring door or window? In the midst of my perplexities, an anxiety of a far more urgent kind presented itself. My dear child began to lose her looks and health, and that in a manner so mysterious and even horrible that I became thoroughly frightened. She was at first visited by appalling dreams, then, as she fancied, by a spectre, sometimes resembling Millarca, sometimes in the shape of a beast, indistinctly seen walking round the foot of her bed from side to side. Lastly came sensations, One, not unpleasant, but very peculiar, she said, resembled the flow of an icy stream against her breast. At a later time, she felt something like a pair of large needles pierce her, a little below the throat, with a very sharp pain. A few nights after, followed a gradual and convulsive sense of strangulation. Then came unconsciousness. I could hear distinctly every word the kind old general was saying, because by this time we were driving upon the short grass that spreads on either side of the road as you approach the roofless village, which had not shown the smoke of a chimney for more than half a century. You may guess how strangely I felt, as I heard my own symptoms so exactly described in those which had been experienced by the poor girl, who, but for the catastrophe which followed, would have been at that moment a visitor at my father's chateau. You may suppose, also, how I felt, as I heard him detail habits and mysterious peculiarities, which were, in fact, those of our beautiful guest, Carmilla. A vista opened in the forest. We were on a sudden under the chimneys and gables of the ruined village, and the towers and battlements of the dismantled castle, round which gigantic trees are grouped, overhung us from a slight eminence. In a frightened dream I got down from the carriage, and in silence, for we had each abundant matter for thinking, we soon mounted the ascent, and were among the spacious chambers, winding stairs, and dark corridors of the castle.
"And this was once the palatial residence of the Karnsteins," said the old general at length, as from a great window he looked out across the village, and saw the wide, undulating expanse of forest. "It was a bad family, and here its blood-stained annals were written," he continued. "It is hard that they should, after death, continue to plague the human race with their atrocious lusts. That is the chapel of the Karnsteins, down there."
He pointed down to the gray walls of the Gothic building partly visible through the foliage, a little way down the steep.
"And I hear the axe of a woodman," he added, "busy among the trees that surround it. He possibly may give us the information of which I am in search, and point out the grave of Mircalla, Countess of Karnstein. These rustics preserve the local traditions of great families, whose stories die out among the rich and titled so soon as the families themselves become extinct."
"We have a portrait, at home, of Mircalla, the Countess Karnstein. Should you like to see it?"
asked my father.
"Time enough, dear friend," replied the general. "I believe that I have seen the original, and one motive which has led me to you earlier than I first intended was to explore the chapel which we are now approaching."
"What? See the Countess Mircalla?" exclaimed my father. "Why, she has been dead more than a century."
"Not so dead as you fancy, I am told," answered the general.
"I confess, general, you puzzle me utterly," replied my father, looking at him, I fancied for a moment with a return of the suspicion I detected before. But although there was anger and detestation at times in the old general's manner, there was nothing flighty.
"There remains to me," he said,
as we passed under the heavy arch of the Gothic church, for its dimensions would have justified its being so styled,
"but one object which can interest me during the few years that remain to me on earth, and that is to wreak on her the vengeance which I thank God may still be accomplished by a mortal man."
"What vengeance can you mean?" asked my father, in increasing amazement.
"I mean to decapitate the monster," he answered,
with a fierce flush and a stamp that echoed mournfully through the hollow ruin, and his clenched hand was at the same moment raised, as if it grasped the handle of an axe, while he shook it ferociously in the air.
"What?"
exclaimed my father, more than ever bewildered.
"To strike her head off."
"Cut her head off?"
"Aye, with a hatchet, with a spade, or with anything that can cleave through her murderous throat." "You shall hear," he answered,
trembling with rage. And hurrying forward, he said,
"That beam will answer for a seat. Your dear child is fatigued. Let her be seated, and I will, in a few sentences, close my dreadful story."
The squared block of wood, which lay on the grass-grown pavement of the chapel, formed a bench on which I was very glad to seat myself, and in the meantime the general called to the woodman, who had been removing some boughs which leaned upon the old walls, and, axe in hand, the hardy old fellow stood before us. He could not tell us anything of these monuments, but there was an old man, he said, a ranger of this forest, at present sojourning in the house of the priest about 2 miles away, who could point out every monument of the old Karnstein family, and for a trifle he undertook to bring him back with him, if we would lend him one of our horses, in little more than half an hour.
"Have you been long employed about this forest?" asked my father of the old man. "I have been a woodman here," he answered in his patois, "under the forester all my days. So has my father before me, and so on, as many generations as I can count up. I could show you the very house in the village here in which my ancestors live."
"How came the village to be deserted?" asked the general.
"It was troubled by revenants, sir. Several were tracked to their graves, there detected by the usual tests, and extinguished in the usual way, by decapitation, by the stake, and by burning, but not until many of the villagers were killed. But after all these proceedings according to law," he continued, "so many graves opened and so many vampires deprived of their horrible animation, the village was not relieved. But a Moravian nobleman, who happened to be traveling this way, heard how matters were, and being skilled, as many people are in his country, in such affairs, he offered to deliver the village from its tormentor. He did so thus. There being a bright moon that night, he ascended, shortly after sunset, the towers of the chapel here, from whence he could distinctly see the churchyard beneath him. You can see it from that window. From this point he watched until he saw the vampire come out of his grave, and place near it the linen clothes in which he had been folded, and then glide away towards the village to plague its inhabitants. The stranger, having seen all this, came down from the steeple, took the linen wrappings of the vampire, and carried them up to the top of the tower, which he again mounted. When the vampire returned from his prowlings and missed his clothes, he cried furiously to the Moravian, whom he saw at the summit of the tower, and who, in reply, beckoned him to ascend and take them. Whereupon the vampire, accepting his invitation, began to climb the steeple, and so soon as he had reached the battlements, the Moravian, with a stroke of his sword, clove his skull in twain, hurling him down to the churchyard, whither, descending by the winding stairs, the stranger followed and cut his head off, and next day delivered it and the body to the villagers, who duly impaled and burnt them. This Moravian nobleman had authority from the then head of the family to remove the tomb of Mircalla, Countess Karnstein, which he did effectually, so that in a little while its site was quite forgotten. "Can you point out where it stood?" asked the general eagerly. The forester shook his head and smiled.
"Not a soul living can tell you that now," he said. "Besides, they say her body was removed, but no one is sure of that, either."
Having thus spoken, as time pressed, he dropped his axe and departed, leaving us to hear the remainder of the general's strange story. End of chapter 13.
Hey everyone, thanks again for listening to Black Clock Audio Tales, and remember to rate, review, and subscribe to the show wherever you rate, review, and subscribe. Help support the show so that we don't have to have advertisements from other people, or even us even, by going to pgttcm.threadless.com and picking up a t-shirt or two, or you can always go to paypal.me/pgttcm and donating a couple of dollars, or going to pgttcm.com www.podbean.com and joining our patron program. And all right, thank you so much, and back to the story.
Carmilla by J. Sheridan LeFanu, read by Elizabeth Klett. Chapter 14. The Meeting.
"My beloved child," he resumed, "was now growing rapidly worse. The physician who attended her had failed to produce the slightest impression on her disease, for such I then supposed it to be. He saw my alarm, and suggested a consultation. I called in an abler physician from Graz. Several days elapsed before he arrived. He was a good and pious as well as a learned man. Having seen my poor ward together, they withdrew to my library to confer and discuss. I, from the adjoining room, where I awaited their summons, heard these two gentlemen's voices raised in something sharper than a strictly philosophical discussion. I knocked at the door and entered. I found the old physician from Graz maintaining his theory. His rival was combating it with undisguised ridicule, accompanied with bursts of laughter. This unseemly manifestation subsided, and the altercation ended on my entrance.
"Sir," said my first physician, "my learned brother seems to think that you want a conjurer and not a doctor."
"Pardon me," said the old physician from Graz, looking displeased. "I shall state my own view of the case in my own way another time. I grieve, Monsieur le Général, that by my skill and science I can be of no use. Before I go, I shall do myself the honor to suggest something to you."
He seemed thoughtful, and sat down at a table and began to write. Profoundly disappointed, I made my bow, and as I turned to go, the other doctor pointed over his shoulder to his companion, who was writing, and then, with a shrug, significantly touched his forehead. This consultation, then, left me precisely where I was. I walked out into the grounds, all but distracted. The doctor from Graz in 10 or 15 minutes overtook me. He apologized for having followed me, but said that he could not conscientiously take his leave without a few words more. He told me that he could not be mistaken. No natural disease exhibited the same symptoms, and that death was already very near. There remained, however, a day, or possibly two, of life. If the fatal seizure were at once arrested, with great care and skill her strength might possibly return. But all hung now upon the confines of the irrevocable. One more assault might extinguish the last spark of vitality which is, every moment, ready to die.
"And what is the nature of the seizure you speak of?" I entreated.
"I have stated all fully in this note, which I place in your hands upon the distinct condition that you send for the nearest clergyman, and open my letter in his presence, and on no account read it till he is with you. You would despise it else, and it is a matter of life and death. Should the priest fail you, then, indeed you may read it."
He asked me, before taking his leave finally, whether I would wish to see a man curiously learned upon the very subject, which, after I had read his letter, would probably interest me above all others, and he urged me earnestly to invite him to visit him there, and so took his leave. The ecclesiastic was absent, and I read the letter by myself. At another time or in another case it might have excited my ridicule. But into what quackeries will not people rush for a last chance, where all accustomed means have failed, and the life of a beloved object is at stake? Nothing, you will say, could be more absurd than the learned man's letter. It was monstrous enough to have consigned him to a madhouse. He said that the patient was suffering from the visits of a vampire. The punctures which she described as having occurred near the throat were, he insisted, the insertion of those two long, thin, and sharp teeth, which, it is well known, are peculiar to vampires. And there could be no doubt, he added, as to the well-defined presence of the small, livid mark, which all concurred in describing as that induced by the demon's lips, and every symptom described by the sufferer
was in exact conformity with those recorded in every case of a similar visitation. Being myself wholly skeptical as to the existence of any such portent as the vampire, the supernatural theory of the good doctor furnished, in my opinion, but another instance of learning and intelligence oddly associated with some one hallucination. I was so miserable, however, that rather than try nothing, I acted upon the instructions of the letter. I concealed myself in the dark dressing-room that opened upon the poor patient's room, in which a candle was burning, and watched there till she was fast asleep. I stood at the door, peeping through the small crevice, my sword laid on the table beside me, as my directions prescribed, until a little after one, I saw a large black object, very ill-defined, crawl, as it seemed to me, over the foot of the bed, and swiftly spread itself up to the poor girl's throat, where it swelled, in a moment, into a great, palpitating mass. For a few moments I had stood petrified. I now sprang forward with my sword in my hand. The black creature suddenly contracted towards the foot of the bed, glided over it, and standing on the floor about a yard below the foot of the bed, with a glare of skulking ferocity and horror fixed on me, I saw Millarca. Speculating I know not what, I struck at her instantly with my sword, but I saw her standing near the door, unscathed. Horrified, I pursued and struck again. She was gone, and my sword flew to shivers against the door. I can't describe to you all that passed on that horrible night. The whole house was up and stirring. The spectre Millarca was gone, but her victim was sinking fast, and before the morning dawned, she died.
The old general was agitated. We did not speak to him. My father walked to some little distance, and began reading the inscriptions on the tombstones, and thus occupied he strolled into the door of a side chapel to prosecute his researches. The general leaned against the wall, dried his eyes, and sighed heavily. I was relieved on hearing the voices of Carmilla and Madame, who were at that moment approaching. The voices died away. In this solitude, having just listened to so strange a story, connected as it was with the great and titled dead, whose monuments were mouldering among the dust and ivy around us, and every instant of which bore so awfully upon my own mysterious case, in this haunted spot, darkened by the towering foliage that rose on every side, dense and high above its noiseless walls, a horror began to steal over me, and my heart sank as I thought that my friends were, after all, not about to enter and disturb this triste and ominous scene. The old general's eyes were fixed on the ground, as he leaned with his hand upon the basement of a shattered monument. Under a narrow, arched doorway, surmounted by one of those demoniacal grotesques in which the cynical and ghastly fancy of old Gothic carving delights, I saw very gladly the beautiful face and figure of Carmilla entering the shadowy chapel. I was just about to rise and speak, and nodded, smiling, in answer to her peculiarly engaging smile, when with a cry the old man by my side caught up the woodman's hatchet and started forward. On seeing him, a brutalized change came over her features. It was an instantaneous and horrible transformation, as she made a crouching step backwards. Before I could utter a scream, he struck at her with all his force, but she dived under his blow, and unscathed caught him in her tiny grasp by the wrist. He struggled for a moment to release his arm, but his hand opened, the axe fell to the ground, and the girl was gone. He staggered against the wall. His gray hair stood upon his head, and a moisture shone over his face as if he were at the point of death. The frightful scene had passed in a moment. The first thing I recollect after is Madame standing before me, and impatiently repeating again and again the question, "Where is Mademoiselle Carmilla?" I answered at length, "I don't know. I can't tell. She went there." And I pointed to the door through which Madame had just entered, "only a minute or two since." "But I have been standing there, in the passage. ever since Mademoiselle Carmilla entered, and she did not return. She then began to call, "Carmilla!" through every door and passage and from the windows, but no answer came.
"She called herself Carmilla?" asked the general, still agitated.
"Carmilla, yes," I answered.
"Aye," he said, "that is Millarca. That is the same person who long ago was called Mircalla, Countess Karnstein. Depart from this accursed ground, my poor child, as quickly as you can. Drive to the clergyman's house and stay there till we come. Begone! May you never behold Carmilla more. You will not find her here."
End of chapter 14.
Hey everyone, thanks again for listening to Black Clock Audio Tales. And remember to rate, review, and subscribe to the show wherever you rate, review, and subscribe. Help support the show so that we don't have to have advertisements from other people, or even us even, by going to pgttcm.threadless.com and picking up a t-shirt or two, or you can always go to paypal.me/pgttcm and donating a couple of dollars, or going to pgttcm.podbean.com and joining our patron program. And all right, thank you so much, and back to the story.